Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here, like the guy with the deep voice says. I'm happy to be coming to you from Dallas, Texas, home of KLIF. And as you know, we are now on in Dallas for the first time ever. It's 14 years in and a month in. We finally got a chance to come into the market, and we're thrilled with that. And by the way, I hope everybody had a chance to go down and watch Fox and Friends this morning. We're down at a local diner, Kubi's. Thanks to everybody who came out today. But we do know that we're covering things around the country, around the world. But like maybe you, the number one topic here by all studies is immigration. Number two is the border. Number three is inflation. Tell me if that doesn't sound familiar. But when you talk about a national problem, if I came here in 2016, it would have been the same ranking. Immigration, border, what are we going to do about security? I remember Governor Perry, who's going to be a guest today, handed Barack Obama a list of things that he needed done to say, hey, we're going to need help in Texas with the border. There was kind of confrontations because they just didn't take it serious. Well, compared to Joe Biden, Barack Obama is like Donald Trump because this guy has no interest. And then we get this shocking news yesterday, shouldn't be that surprising, that eight suspected terrorists with ISIS ties were arrested in a sting operation in New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia. Why would Tajikistan residents decide to come through our southern border? Well, it turns out, for not good reasons, we're going to find out more. We will follow it. The FBI and DHS work together. ICE, which has been depleted intentionally because people think it's a racist organization, which it is not, now they're asked to go do extraordinary things. I will tell you, one thing is clear. If you want to be in ICE, and if Donald Trump wins, there'll be opportunity for you. So Christopher Wray said this. He said, look out, America. There's going to be a problem here. Our southern border is a mess. In this state of Texas, they have slowed down illegal immigration 72%. And the president has nothing to do with it. It is all about the governor overcoming lawsuits, putting up his own barbed wire, putting his own National Guard together, Operation Lone Star, at a cost of $11 billion. Think about all the good you could be doing for Texas residents if they didn't have to do the federal government's job. Cut one is Christopher Wray just 1 week ago.
And since then, we've seen the threat from foreign terrorists rise to a whole nother level. This is by no means a time to let up or dial back. But now, on top of that, increasingly concerning is the potential for a coordinated attack here in the homeland, not unlike the ISIS-K attack we saw at the Russia Concert Hall back in March.
Think about that. Can you imagine hearing the story that a theater has been taken over like they happened in France and Paris, like now that happened in Moscow? Now, they don't care. They don't care about their people. People are assassinated going to the movies. Families wiped out. Russia quickly killed them all, maybe in real time, torture them on camera. But they're gone. Those people are dead. And as far as we know, there's no big deal. In America, that would never fly. We care too much about life, and we want to make sure that people are accountable for that type of failure. So we'll talk about that, and I'm going to talk about that with Lieutenant Colonel Alan West as well as Rich Lowry. By the way, FBI, we put him down a lot. I don't like what Peter Strzok did. Andy McCabe is, I think, a terrible human being. But a lot of these men and women do extraordinary things. They don't make much money. There's only about 35,000 of them, and they're asked to do heroic efforts on a daily basis. I mean, to track these guys down and get them, unbelievable. Next, Hunter Biden, the decision yesterday, guilty. No kidding, he's guilty. I mean, my goodness, he actually spelled it out and texted out his guilt. Then we have video of the gun that he was charged with being tossed into a dumpster that he never should have gotten because he was addicted to drugs. Was he addicted to drugs? No, says his lawyer. However, his text message says, meeting Mookie to buy drugs. What day? The same day. I mean, and which I think is really horrible and understated, is he gets Haley Biden addicted to crack, too. I mean, think about this. He gets the widow of Beau Biden addicted to crack. Everyone around him is being tortured. They're covering for him nonstop. Now this story comes out, and people want to offer him sympathy. I have no sympathy for the guy. Remember, he grandstanded outside Congress. Remember, he came into a hearing, which he said he was going to go to. He says, I want to go testify live in front of everybody. They said, first go behind closed doors, and then he storms in with Abby Lowell and his producer. His producer is actually putting him up in a house in Malibu, paying all his legal bills. It is so bad that the daughter of the producer went up to Hunter Biden and says, "You are taking advantage of my dad." Before anyone gets a heart goes out to Hunter Biden, keep in mind, he's still grubbing off the name. He's still leeching off people, and he shows no regret until he got caught. Here's Jonathan Turley on the case, Cut 12.
Unlike the Manhattan case, this judge was right down the middle. I mean, she ruled for the defense on major issues, ruled for the prosecutors on some major issues. This was a very fair trial in the federal courts, so I don't see any reversible errors here. Mm. Now, they've tried the ultimate Hail Mary. They've actually ripped a page out of the briefing book of the NRA, and you have Hunter arguing against the law that the president today was calling to be actually strengthened. He's arguing that his Second Amendment rights trump that law.
Right.
But that has not worked for him, and I don't expect it to work in the future.
So he's got a tax deal. He's going to get sentenced before September 5th when he goes on trial for taxes. And then we have the made-for-TV moment as Joe Biden changes his schedule to rush back to Delaware. The guy is 100 years old. He decides to fly back to Delaware, do a Juneteenth event, and then be there as his son is convicted, so we all get to see him on the sidewalk, on the driveway, hug his son and his granddaughter to look like a human being. I mean, just understand that they're just playing out this soap opera. He's fully to blame. The family's been thoroughly exposed. People have problems in their family. Well, would you ever have your daughter testify for you and then have to reveal all the details about the dad, what he was up to, going to school with no money, strung out on drugs? She's talking about the stress she's going through. Then we have the problem with Bo Biden's widow. Then we have the $5 million he owes in child support, the woman he doesn't own up to. It's a bad guy. But according to Democrats, this is just showing you that justice is blind. Listen to Juan Williams, Cut 19.
I don't see it ironic. I think the son did it, right? And he was found guilty. But it seems to me that after the Trump claims of rigged justice system, John, that this verdict has much broader political impact than that. I think the impact is it undercuts what Trump has been saying about the justice system being weaponized against him. This argument just blows that apart. I mean, this is the son of the president of the United States being prosecuted by the president's justice.
Okay, I can't even listen to this. So Juan Williams never used to be this ideological, but I wanted you to hear it because that's what's going on other channels. And many people don't listen to other channels or other stations, and I appreciate that. So Juan, that is the argument. So this shows you that Trump's guilty and should accept his verdict because the crackhead actually got caught with buying a gun, lying on a gun form, picking up hookers, getting women pregnant, denying them access. This happened years ago. The only reason it happened this year is because they had a sweetheart deal that was hatched behind closed doors that was blown up by a level-headed judge that said nobody should be exonerated and immune from their crimes just because they're the son of a president. So Abby Lowell takes this to trial a year later, and people say this shows you this true justice. Because one court case got it right. It doesn't mean New York got it right. They didn't. And it's not patriotic or unpatriotic to criticize a jury's decision. We have that right. They're jurors of your peers. They came up with a conclusion about the information and the evidence that they were exposed to. That doesn't mean anything to do with this case, but that's what they were running with last night on CNN. Hopefully not in your mind, but we'll see what happens. This will be a debate issue. And I just wonder how assured that President Biden will be when he says convicted felon Donald Trump. Because now it's convicted felon Hunter Biden. Yeah, you're Hunter Biden, the smartest man you know who's done nothing wrong, if I will quote you exactly. So when we come back, I'm going to talk to Rich Lowry about the ramifications of this. 2 weeks into the debate, 3 weeks until we find out about the sentencing. 1 month until we find out about the sentencing of Donald Trump, arguably the biggest day up until November 5th. Then we got the RNC, the DNC that might be so overwhelmed with protesters. Joe Biden might be told to do it virtually. What an embarrassment. While the president of the United States sits over the G7, he'll be over in Italy talking to a reaffirmed, boisterous right wing in Maloney. Prime Minister Maloney. Macron got a shot to the solar plexus. Olaf Scholz got a rebuke. The people of Europe are as upset about their border, the climate change rules and regulations, as you are. and they've answered back with the elections. Will America follow suit? So much going on. Thanks so much for tuning to the Brian Kilmeade Show, live from the studios of KLIF in downtown Dallas.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
That if we can get this deal in place, in phase one, the fighting stops. The fighting stops all across the Gaza. That's what phase one is all about. That's how you get the hostages out safely. And that's how you get, hopefully, up to 600 trucks a day going into Gaza is with a calm, a sustainable calm that can potentially lead to phase two, which is which could lead to a cessation of hostilities altogether. So if the deal's entered into by both sides, then you get a ceasefire at least for 6 weeks, which means no fighting anywhere in Gaza.
That is Admiral Kirby spinning what I think is just the worst run support for any ally that I can remember in my lifetime. They are trying to force a peace deal, a ceasefire deal on Israel instead of letting them do what they have to do, and that is wipe out their enemy so they don't strike again. Instead, they're trying to get him to survive is the only thing I could think of. Admiral Kirby just spinning away. Rich Lowry will not fall for it. He joins us now. Rich, welcome. Your thought about a peace deal that, by the way, Israel says Hamas has not agreed to, and they will not to agree to the new terms they came back with.
Yeah, so I think the only reason Israel is motivated to have any sort of ceasefire deal, which would work to Hamas's interest, is one, getting hostages back, which they care a lot about because they're civilized society, and two, pressure from us. Otherwise, you know, this is just a deal that would allow Hamas to dig more tunnels, to try to refit, to try to survive and fight for another day, which is the ultimate game. And Sinwar, the head of Hamas, thinks they're doing pretty well because there have been so many civilian casualties in Gaza, which is what they want, to create pressure on Israel to stop.
So Hamas's top officials, you're quoting Reuters now, in Gaza, said Sinwar, who masterminded this whole operation October 7th, admitted he sees the deaths of Palestinian civilians as necessary sacrifices to keep the war against Israel raging. Sinwar lauded his efforts in installing ceasefire talks while the Jewish state faces mounting international backlash. And we are playing right into it.
Yeah.
Think about that. Bin Laden loving the fact that we haven't found him yet. And one, the fact is when people started, if people started being upset that we were still in Afghanistan and us giving into it and our allies pressuring us to get out there, we are actually showing that we're on Sinwar's side.
Yeah, exactly. When Kamala Harris says, oh, you know, I'm glad there's a couple hostages that are out, but I mourn the Palestinian civilians, she's playing right into his hands. That's what he wants, and it's been obvious for all along, right? Why do you put fighters in the hospitals unless you want the hospitals to get hit so you can complain about it? Why do you have hostages in civilian homes unless you want, if Israel rescues them, civilians to get killed? And why do you resist the hostage rescues unless you want a big battle in a crowded area? You know, and the idea that the press and the U.S. government are still taking the Gaza health ministry seriously, that number 274 of supposed civilian casualties drove the coverage of the rescue operation. You know, this incredibly daring, successful operation that they should make a movie about suddenly became a bad thing because the Gaza health ministry said so.
Meanwhile, the other story is a journalist for the Palestinian Journalist who also worked for Al Jazeera was holding two hostages.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make it up. The guy was very well-sourced, Brian, among hostage takers. He knew exactly what hostage takers were thinking at any given moment throughout this crisis. No, it's crazy. And the hostages are kind of parceled out as slaves. You know, the woman who was famously taken from the rave, you know, on that motorbike, and that horrifying scene was working hand and foot for a well-off family in this refugee camp that's really a city. It's not a refugee camp. It's been there forever. But this is hideous, right? I mean, this is medieval stuff. But people, there's like a moral perversion in people's vision. They can't make the distinction between the hostage taker and the hostage rescuers.
And listen to this, Rich Lowry of National Review. You wrote a great column on it. Israel deserves praise, of course. I feel like we're the only sane ones. And that's when the president comes back, bring back common sense. This is part of the bracket under common sense. But listen to what's happening in New York, what happened over the weekend in around the White House. Listen to this protester, cut 25.
Why are you here? You have nothing to do.
I wish Hitler was still here.
Go home.
I wish Hitler was still here. They want to wipe all your out. They want to wipe all your out.
You believe this?
Yeah.
I wish Hitler was still here. These idiots outside a memorial for the October 7th victims.
Yeah, and you know the crazy thing about that, Brian? That's the first I'd heard of that, right? If you'd had a right-wing rally where one person had said that, it would be national headlines, right? And you know, perhaps understandably. But this is routine kind of sentiments at these protests. There's a rabbi, you know, was harassed at UCLA, a journalist who was assaulted and pushed into or at least toward a trash can, and it's happening all the time. I mean, you know, the old left-wing slogan is if they show you who they are, show you who they are, believe them. They're showing us who they are every day.
It is. And by the way, I'm wondering when Anthony Blinken is going to look in the mirror and say, I have no policy. I really have no policy on Ukraine. I have no policy when it comes to Iran. I have no policy when it comes to Israel. Are you condemning Iran after they basically surrounded Israel with enemies? Are you supporting Israel? Are you going halfway with Ukraine, giving them somewhat permission? First, we earmark $64 billion, took too long, to get to Ukraine. None of it's gotten there yet. That's the story. Instead, our president overseas insults Republicans to Zelensky twice. I mean, what is going on here? What happened to common
policy,
sense?
The thread that runs through their policy is restraining our allies, right? That's what they've done in Ukraine. There might have been a golden hour there in the first year where if we'd backed them to the hilt, they might have been able to push the Russians all the way back. And Israel now. You know, in that Time magazine interview, the interviewer asked, well, do you think Netanyahu is stretching out the war for political purposes? And by the way, yeah, he might be doing that. No, you know, the U.S. administration has stretched it out by pulling all sorts of levers to try to keep Israel from finishing the job.
If they just let him go into Rafah months ago, they wouldn't even be talking about should they go into Rafah. And what they discovered there is a ton of Egyptian tunnels that they denied that were there.
Yep.
And that is why the Middle East did not want us to go in there. Rich, first off, do you think that that Trump's in a good stead right now in this race?
I do. You know, I think that there's some polling that showed he was hurt a smidge by the guilty verdict, you know, lost a point in a poll here or there. Some double haters and independents particularly didn't seem to like the verdict. But I still think he's a step ahead. I still think he'd win today. And I still think he has a better than 50% chance of winning in November, just because the core issues that the race is about, you know, the economy, the border, who's a strong leader, who has a vision for the country, who's going to make you better off financially. Trump is way ahead on all that stuff. And
right.
I just think it's really hard for Biden to overcome it. Maybe he will, and maybe he'll draw kind of the inside straight that Trump got in 16 you know, lose all the swing states except for the three he needs to keep. You know.
Pick up National Review, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, right here in Dallas next.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What scares me the most about my coverage of the border and what I hear the most from my border contacts is that the vetting, as you just mentioned, is wholly inadequate at the border. When you get guys from Iran, from Tajikistan, from Syria, there's no database to match these guys against. What Border Patrol agents tell us is even if they get fingerprints, the only way they know about somebody's criminal history often is if they've committed a crime in the United States. Bashar al-Assad isn't sharing database records with the U.S. on Syrian citizens, right? So what does the U.S. do? We still mass catch and release single adult men from these potentially hostile countries into the United States.
Yeah.
En masse. We see it in San Diego sector. We're the only country on the face of the planet that does this. It's remarkable.
And that is Bill Malusian, who's covered, along with Griff Jenkins, the border more than anybody else in the country and done a fantastic job. Also got to thank our drone team for displaying how bad the situation is and making other networks cover it. And, of course, Bill Malusian on last night with Trace Gallagher because he was talking about this news story. Eight suspected terrorists with ISIS ties arrested in sting operations in New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia. And that's what we know of. Shaking his head right now, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. He's with the American Constitutional Rights Union, and he runs the the Dallas Republican Club, right?
Dallas County Republican Party, yeah.
Yeah, great to see you.
It's good to be with you, man.
Thanks for coming down for a big event last night at KLIF in that great restaurant. First off, what I just told you, you're shaking your head. You can't believe that this is happening in America.
No, I can't. And
after a war on terror, we all went to Terror University as a country.
And now we have opened up our borders to the fact we're allowing these terrorists to come in. And, you know, I don't see how this is not something that we are looking into. When you look at how Joe Biden reversed all the previous policies unconstitutionally by executive orders, 90-plus executive orders, he has really said to all of the bad elements in the world, come on into the United States of America. More single military age males in the United States of America than we have in our active duty United States Army. More gotaways than we have of our entire active duty United States military. This is a constitutional crisis, and this is something that does not lead to a good end, a good result.
And, you know, the thing is, it's not Texas alone anymore. It's not New Mexico with a Democratic governor not saying what they really believe. And what's happening in California with that, with everyone overrated governor? Mm-hmm. He's an epic fail. People got to look at his record. But now your crossings are down 70%+,
mm-hmm.
and San Diego sector's up 76%.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where they're all going.
Well, sure. I mean, you're going to go and find the path of least resistance. So at least we do have a governor here that is trying to do something, even though you have a federal government that's trying to stymie his efforts in every way, shape, form, or fashion, which, again, is unconstitutional. So that really is, I think, is going to be the major issue going in because it affects our economy, it affects our education, it affects our health care, it affects our everyday security.
I hear that schools are overrun now.
Yes.
They're overrun with people who speak languages that we're not capable of understanding. It's not Spanish. It's not Mexico. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's not Central and South America anymore. And it taxes the schools. I don't know mm-hmm. how your teachers feel about it, but that directly affects them.
Well, they're not able to teach. And that's the problem, not just for them not being able to teach, but it's also a problem for the students not being able to be instructed and to be taught. So this, again, like I say, with our healthcare system, and one of the things that upsets me, you know, Friday will be the 268th birthday of the United States Army. Oh, hold on, that's about right. 48th, I'm sorry. We're putting illegal immigrants over our veterans. And that is very, very disconcerting. When we look at all the free benefits that illegal immigrants are getting, debit cards, and we still have homeless and jobless veterans, we still have veterans with a very, very high suicide rate, we're upside down in our country.
I want you to hear what Vic Baja said last night on Fox News at night about maybe legal action we should be taking. Cut six.
If I were a professor in a law school class, I would say, yes, Trace, there's recourse. But having our fingers on the pulse of the legal community in reality and real life, I would say, who's going to bring the case? Mm-hmm. Do you think San Diego is going to bring the case against a federal government? Do you think Los Angeles will? What about San Francisco? Name me a city that's irreparably harmed by this unmitigated, unsurveilled, loose immigration, which inevitably can lead to a percentage of criminals.
Right.
Find me one city. Give me one name of one that'll say, yes, we're going to go ahead and go after the Biden administration. It's just not right.
Well, Texas is. I mean, yes. You guys have been suing each other back and forth. They're suing you guys for trying to enforce your own border. They got the buoys out of the Rio Grande.
No, you're absolutely right. And what a sad thing. And we're not talking about, a long distance. We're talking about, half a mile to a mile of these buoys. But any type of impediment we can put out there, about the park that we took over there. Shelby Park. And I've been there. And you try to get the federal government and their agencies to come in and kick us out.
They're afraid to kick you out now.
Oh, yeah.
They're right, because they know it's working, number one. Number two, they're trying to show they're tough on the border. Now that everyone's paying attention,
mm-hmm.
You go sue a state for sealing its own border. You have no case.
You don't have a case. You don't have a case, really, when you look at the Constitution as well. But you definitely don't have a case with the American people. And I think that a lot of these, band-aids that the Biden administration is trying to use now, people see through it. They understand it's political.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, I mean, that's what's seen at the border. You just told me a couple of things. Number one, Dallas went, where we are right now in KLIF Studios 570. Dallas won 62-35 for Joe Biden, the city of Dallas.
Yeah.
You tell me that you like the county, but the C's a mess.
Well, yeah, and really when you look at Dallas County, it's a D+18 county. That means 18% more Democrats. But I think when you look at Dallas and the level of crime that is happening here and the fact that the Dallas City Council kind of backhanded, defunded the police, we're about 1,000 to 1,100 police officers short down here. People are concerned about that. When you look at the fact that Dallas is the number two city in the United States of America for sex trafficking, something that a lot of people don't know about, folks are concerned about that. So I think we have a great opportunity in this election cycle to make a difference in these major urban population centers where you see a lack of economic opportunity, you see a lack of safety and security, you see businesses that are suffering because of the high rise of crime. And the crime here in Dallas affects two demographics the most, blacks and Hispanics.
See, not many people know that about Dallas. We think Austin is the problem. You're saying Dallas is the problem?
Dallas is a problem as well because 4 years ago in the 2020 election cycle, Democrats outvoted Republicans in Dallas County by 291,076 votes. What we got to do is we got to make sure we start to decrease that and not allow the Democrats to increase
it. What about the fact that your mayor flipped to the Republican Party? How is that resonating? Is he doing a better job now? Do you feel as though his star is rising?
Well, the thing here in Dallas is, it is not a strong mayoral position. It's a strong city manager position.
Unlike New York. Where
unlike,
the mayor does
absolutely. Have. Unlike New York. So we'll see what happens in the future. But we'd like to see Mayor Johnson, Eric Johnson, be a little bit more, visible here with Republicans in the county and in Dallas also, instead of a lot of this national mayoral association things that he's doing.
What I want to do is come back and talk about the president's message. The president's message when it comes to African-Americans, what he said on Juneteenth from the White House lawn, what he said to Morehouse, the predominantly black college, all-male college, I think needs to be addressed. I want to get your perspective on it as this thing called a African-American Republican. So
just a black Republican.
Right, black Republican.
I've never been to Africa.
Okay.
I'm from Georgia.
Yeah, I said that one time, too, when Jesse Jackson that started this.
Yeah.
And I said that, and the guy I was working for was black, and he said, African-American, right? And he goes, no, I'm from the Caribbean. It's an insult.
Yes.
Right.
So, my wife is Jamaican. You do not say that to my wife. Yeah.
Right, but I'm sure she gets it, right?
Yeah, yeah, but she doesn't like it.
All right, so you're not going to be mad at me, are you?
No, man, you're not. We simpatico, man.
I don't know what language that is. Back in a moment. We're here at the studios of KLIF. Back in a moment with Colonel Alan West. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It was about a statement of faith, a testimony of a testament to the resilience of generations of black Americans who kept their eyes set on the nation's North Star. That North Star was the idea that we're all created equal, in the image of God, and deserve to be treated equally throughout our lives. While we've never lived up to it, we've never fully walked away from it either.
So what a great inspiring message on a Juneteenth celebration a week early. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is here. Yeah. We're here in Dallas, Texas, KLAF Studios. But I just want to get your take on that message from the president. Does that resonate? Because he's desperate to stop bleeding black support.
No, it doesn't resonate. And I think it's so important that we go back and understand what history is. Juneteenth is all about Texas. Because Juneteenth is about the 19th of June of 1865, when Union troops, Union black troops, landed at Galveston and let the slaves there in Texas know, you're free. And that is because of a promise that was kept by a Republican president, the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who did the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1863. And you did a great job with your book talking about Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. But you have to understand, 1854, the Republican Party was established in Wisconsin for one issue, to end slavery. And so to hear, you know, Joe Biden try to claim it and try to talk about it, it is laughable, because this is something that goes back to the history of the Republican Party, and it comes right here. And guess what? 2 years after they found out they were free, 150 black men got together in Houston, Texas on Independence Day of 1867 and created the Republican Party of Texas.
He wants to go back, and he says, we want to go back in the future, remember about the way it was with separate but equal and the Jim Crow days. Do we remember that was the Democratic Party?
That was the Democrats. Yeah.
So I want you to hear this, because I don't think anyone informed him of this, which he should, because one of his best friends was Senator Byrd.
Robert Byrd, West Virginia.
Let's listen.
My name's Joe Biden, and I'm a lifetime member of the NAACP. Matter of fact, the first organization I ever joined was the NAACP. Didn't get to vote till you were 21 in those days, but I got involved in civil rights when I was 15.
Not true. he became a member in his 20s, and he said on camera, I was never someone, an activist involved with civil rights,
yeah,
and had another throwaway statement. That the problem is Joe Biden can't rationalize Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And he also said, and I want you to hear this cut, Colonel. This is the cut when he talked about going back and talked about old garments.
But let's be clear. They're old ghosts and new garments trying to take us back. Well, there are. Taking away your freedoms, making it harder for black people to vote. Or have your vote counted. Closing doors of opportunity. Attacking the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you can believe it, banning books about black experience in America. Trying to erase and rewrite.
Okay, I can't hear it anymore. But do you understand his theme?
Yeah. Yeah. It, what he's trying to do is stir up a pot. And really, he's playing on the lack of historical understanding. You know, you want to talk about the NAACP. The NAACP was founded by four white progressives at the turn of the century. W.B. Du Bois was put in charge of it. He was an avowed socialist. He ended up renouncing his American citizenship and becoming a full-blown communist. So, you know, enough about the NAACP. But when he talks about old ghosts with new garments, that's the Democrat Party. Remember in 2012 when he stood there in Virginia, said they're going to put y'all back in chains?
Sure.
That was horrible English, first and foremost. But the only people that have ever put blacks in chains in the United States of America is the Democrat Party. Now they're trying to put us in economic chains. When you look at the inner cities, when you look at the lack of educational opportunities, Joe Biden does not support school choice. And he wants black kids to be relegated to failing schools.
Right. And in New York in particular, they're trying to keep them out of charter schools. Charter schools, they demand more.
Yes.
They longer days, better performance, better results. The money is there. The buildings are there. But the teachers' unions don't want any more charter schools because they're not unionized.
Absolutely.
And I even mentioned that Charlemagne the God, he had no idea, which is I found stunning. But he says he's looking into it. But a couple of things for you. What is he talking about? What is it even based in? Because he's talking about the Georgia voting laws.
Mm-hmm.
He said Jim Crow 2.0, trying to stop you from voting. Is it an insult to any group of people to say you can't get an ID?
Yes, it is.
Really? Am I that much of a moron? I can't get an ID?
I mean, think about it. Okay, you know, I fly on airplanes. I just got back from Normandy, France. I had a picture ID. I had a passport.
Can't get anywhere.
Yeah, so in other words, you're telling me I'm too stupid to be able to get an ID? It is condescending. It's offensive. It's disgraceful. And the fact that you have people that will follow along and believe in that is very disconcerting.
Who won the Senate race? Senator Warnock twice or three times?
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
I'm pretty sure he's black.
And right? And you saw an increase
in turnout
in Georgia after that law was passed.
So there was nothing. You think he'd back off it? Instead, he's saying Republicans want to do it. But the DEI is an interesting conversation because a lot of Democrats think it sucks. 44% of corporations are walking away from it.
Yeah.
Didn't someone inform him that your attitude of the cancel culture, DEI, has totally flipped because the people that started it had it blow up in their face? I don't know who wrote that speech, but I'm wondering what era they're running. They think it's 2018.
The leftists are in a box, and they don't talk outside of their own echo chamber. And they are going to continue to harbor on this, just the same as he continues to tell us that the economy is doing well when most people understand that it is not doing well.
So if you're Trump, what strategy works? You know, in most polls, 20-24% of the vote, which is stunning, considering I think they were at one point, I think Romney got 8% of the black vote.
Yes, he did.
So if you're at 20-24, if you're Trump says to you, how do I keep this going? How could I resonate in the black community? What would you tell him?
I would tell him to continue to talk about the issues that are affecting the black community. Continue to talk about the economic opportunities. You know, the thing that he had with the economic empowerment zones in the inner cities. Continue to talk about the education issue, as you and I were discussing, his support to historical black colleges and universities that he did. Continue to talk about the lack of policing and safety and security in the inner city communities, which is so important.
I want to do something that might be futuristic, but I think we're ready for it. All I would say is I'm here to level the playing field for everybody. I will not talk about Hispanics anymore, women anymore. I want to level the playing field. Anything stopping you, I'm going to block for you to make sure you have an equal chance to score.
Well, what you're
be successful.
What you're talking about is equality of opportunity.
That's it.
That's
not outcome.
No, not outcomes. Not equality of outcomes, which is what equity is.
Yeah.
And I think that if he could make that delineation, that will help him go.
We got to get to stop at this point. Let's go get the black vote. Let's get the white vote. Yeah. Let's get the seniors. Now, if you're a strategist, I understand. You know, you ran for office. You understand what districts are different and what they. I get that, but every day we're getting up and hearing about different sects. It just separates people.
We're balkanizing ourselves. And the greatness of Ronald Reagan was he just talked about America. And he talked about how we want to have a better quality of life for all Americans. He didn't segment people out. And I think you're right. If we could have a leader that stands up and talk about everybody. You know, when I was a commander in the military, I didn't talk to the black troops, different from the Hispanic troops, different from the white troops, different from the troops from rural areas. They were soldiers. That was it. And I talked about what it meant to be a soldier.
Right. And, Colonel, were you held back at all? I mean,
no.
The lieutenant colonel, you didn't feel as though you were held back?
I want you to think about something. You're looking at a kid that was born in 1961 in a blacks-only hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. My dad was a corporal in World War II, but yet his middle son became a lieutenant colonel and a member of Congress. That's equality of opportunity.
And if you felt as though you were being discriminated against, you would have called it out.
Yeah, and you know what my dad taught me, and it's inscribed in my house. He said, always find out what the standard is and exceed it. That's what he taught me.
Find a way. That's Booker T. Washington.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Stop judging. Just deal with it get it better.
Get it done.
Right. Get it done. And he had that battle with W.B. Du Bois constantly, who was very well read, but never had the experiences of Booker T. Washington. And he had this huge legacy. W.B. Du Bois had a huge mind.
Yeah.
Well studied. Didn't like the country.
That book learning stuff.
That book learning stuff. Hey, I'm here in beautiful KLIF studios. Colonel Alan West, thanks so much for joining
me.
Thanks
for having me.
I appreciate it. It was great to see you last night,
Absolutely.
Too. Keep it here. The Brian Kilmeade Show on the road.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here on the road in Dallas, normally up in 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. On the road today, we're lucky enough to be expanding our family of affiliates. The KLIF in Dallas is now part of it. WTIC also joined this week. We're thrilled to be in Hartford, Connecticut. I used to work up there at the NBC affiliate on TV doing all sports. So thrilled that the show continues to grow, and we're always happy to say just a few months ago, we're on in Richmond now, so we're thrilled to be there. This hour, going to be joined by Tom Fitton. He puts in perspective how Hunter Biden ended up being brought up on gun charges. Because a lot of people are saying, well, you know, really, out of everything he's done, how did that happen? It's really 100% him to blame and everyone that tried to cover for him. And then Governor Rick Perry, the 14th U.S. Secretary of Energy, too, did a fantastic job. I know President Trump has great respect for what he did. And you should all understand how great he was making us truly an energy exporter instead of an importer. And that was blown up under President Biden. Before we get to the governor of Texas, let's get to the former governor of Texas. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three. It should come as a shock to no one that Mr. Sinwar cares nothing at all about the lives of innocent Palestinians that have been caught up in this war, a war he started.
That is Admiral John Kirby. He's talking about loving it. Sinwar, the Hamas mastermind, admits what we all knew. He wants Palestinians to die. He reportedly said the Palestinian deaths are a necessary sacrifice as Israel rejects Hamas's counter demands for a ceasefire and anti-Israel protests rage in New York and D.C.
Number two.
Politically, this is a big blow to Trump. He's trying so hard to create this weaponization.
Most people see this and feel sympathy.
A day that provided very clear evidence that the justice system is not weaponized.
Yes, exactly. That is the spin, and that's what they're saying. Hunter convicted, jurors speak, Trump haters call it all even on the justice front. I'm not one of them.
Number one.
We've seen the threat from foreign terrorists rise to a whole nother level. This is by no means a time to let up or dial back.
That is the head of the FBI 1 week ago. Terrorists among us. Border breaches have the FBI hunting down 8 would-be terrorists in the U.S. in 3 separate major cities, and the illegals continue to pour in. The bright side, and the bright spot happens to be Texas, where they've taken things into their own hands at the cost of $11 billion with Operation Lone Star. With us right now is Governor Rick Perry. Governor, I don't have to tell you anything about what's going on at the border. You had a 3-alarm, 5-alarm fire when Barack Obama was there. How much worse is it now?
I don't know whether is it 3X, is it 5X? I mean, it is substantially worse, Brian. And by the way, glad you're in Texas.
Yes.
We love for you to make this home, but we realize from time to time you got to be up there in New York. But
yeah, only Sean Hannity gets to pick his state. So, yeah. Well, I'm not big enough yet.
Yeah, here's the interesting part about it is after what they did to President Trump, any businessman or woman, they should be going, no, wait a minute, where do I want to live? Do I want to live in New York, particularly in New York City, or do I want to live in Texas where the rule of law actually means something? But that's not what you asked me. You asked me about 10 years ago when we were seeing massive amounts of young children, I mean, on the backs of trains coming in through Mexico. I confronted then President Obama about this on the ramp at Dallas.
I remember.
Airport when he had flown in. And, you know, he kind of shrugged his shoulders and went on about his business. And now we're seeing the fruits of that labor exacerbated X numbers of times, as we talked about earlier. Because this, not just administration, but this political party, I think truly wants an open border. The idea that they're entreating people to come up, to turn themselves in, the games that they're playing, what Biden did a week, 10 days ago with his executive order, was totally political, trying to cover his backside, so to speak, with an election coming up. They intend to have as many people in this country as they can, because I really believe that it's about creating more voters so that the Democrat Party can go and manipulate that process and have a overwhelming number of people that are going to come in and just blindly vote Democrat.
But, Governor, the good news is if people aren't tolerating it, they're really not. I mean, but they wanted to do maybe a long-term plan. We, you know, we have Chuck Schumer in the 80s and Harry Reid in the 80s and 90s talking about the need to build a wall. And we got to get a fence. We got to reform it. And all of a sudden they switched. And because they subscribed to the theory that you just brought out. And it might be true. You might be 100% correct. But the American people are rising up. There were 13 Democrats who demanded President Biden do something at the border. Now it's a 50-state problem. You are destroying New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco. It is a 50-state problem. They cannot keep whatever that diabolical dream was, financed by George Soros. The American people said, no, thank you. Don't you agree?
Yeah, and really, if 10 years ago, we had looked at some reasonable options, building some border wall that would slow down in places where it was easy to cross. If we'd have put technology into place with cameras, if we'd have had quick response teams in place where, you know, when we saw these people just starting to cross the border, we could have surged in there. I think you could have used the United States military, and you should have used the United States military at some point in that. But we're so far past that now, and literally the tens of millions of people that have come, we don't know. And more importantly, we don't know who they are, Brian. And that's the real challenge for the next administration and Governor Abbott, who, by the way, you know, he needs to have a great debt of gratitude by the people of America for what he's done to right. slow this down. But he can't do it by himself. We got to have a president.
I know.
Like Donald Trump, who understands you put all of these pieces in this together, and you sit down with the Mexican government, who's going to be a new president in Mexico as well, and say, Madam President, let me tell you, we want to be your partner. We want to be your friend. We want to do trade with you. But here is what you are going to do on this immigration issue. And here is how we're going to take the fight to the cartels. And at that point in time, I think the Mexican government has to say, look, we recognize if we don't have a good working relationship with the United States, we are bankrupt. We turn into an absolute, terrible state of affairs. And that's what you can expect with Donald Trump. And that's why I think you're right. The American people are buying into this open border, this craziness, because it's affecting New York City now. It's affecting, Michigan. It's affecting Wisconsin. It's affecting Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And you add into that the war on fossil fuels that this administration has got. And you think people in Pennsylvania, after they look at the immigration issue, they look at the energy policy, they're going to vote for this guy? Not on your life.
Man, you hit so many great topics. First, I'll take this. When you talk about that Wall Street Journal story and the Time Magazine story, what if Biden wins? And the Wall Street Journal story says he's really out of it behind the scenes. So he's on this phone with Speaker Johnson. And Speaker Johnson said, why did you stop with these natural gas leases in this country? We need it. Japan needs it. Or the Baltic nations need it. Why did you stop? And he said, I didn't stop. This is a study. He said, no, Mr. President, you stopped all leases. And by the way, Pennsylvania got hurt the most. You stopped all new natural gas leases. So the Governor Shapiro, a Democrat, said, I hope this is temporary. And you have a president who thought it was a study. Are you going to tell me Trump would ever be duped into not knowing that they stopped drilling or fracking?
Well, Brian, what this is all about is obviously November politics. This is administration moving the chess pieces that they think. I mean, Joe Biden's not making these decisions. I've got that figured out. And I think most Americans know that he's not sitting there making policy, that there's, you know, a chief of staff, there's this cabal of folks at the White House that are moving the levers. He's basically, here, Mr. President, sign this, and he didn't look at it. He didn't know what it says in most cases, I would bet. But the point is, those LNG permits for the LNG export facilities that they put on pause, that was a powerful message, not just to the oil and gas industry. It was a powerful message to his environmental friends, because they're getting a little bit nervous that he's getting a little flaky on some issues here. So, well, we'll go put this pause. We call it a pause, but it's a stoppage. You can't start and stop these $20, $30 billion projects. I mean, these are incredibly expensive long-term. You've got to go to your financing people and say, here's our long-term, here's our financial sheet, here's the people that have signed 30-year contracts to buy this gas. And when you're jerking the rug out from under them, Brian, it is a devastating message, not just to the oil and gas industry, not just to those states, but to our allies around the world. You got the Europeans that are sitting over there figuring out, well, we've really fouled up with doing away with our natural gas. We're having to rely upon the Russians. We don't like nuclear. and they find themselves in a real pickle.
Right.
And the U.S. was where they were getting their gas. They were counting on us. And then you got the Biden administration that walks in and went, nah, you can't count on us anymore.
Because they're worried about their extreme left. It does. And guess what? This is what gets me encouraged. Because when Trump said the other over the weekend, let's just talk about common sense. He wasn't saying be conservative. He's saying, can we get back to common sense? He was telling the people of Nevada. And then I watched those elections in Europe, and I see the results with the conservatives winning in Italy, the right wing winning in prevailing in Germany and in France, causing them to have another snap election. Listen to what Douglas Murray said that we should take from it. It's the same issues, and they are standing up, and there's backlash. Cut 41.
Are the French voters hard right or far right? No, they just don't like being blown up. You know, it's a kind of basic sentiment. And because Macron and others have failed to answer this, the publics have rebelled. To answer your question about America, I think we'll see something very similar. We know what the situation is on the southern border of this country. We know what the Biden administration has failed to do. If the incumbent government does not wrestle with mass illegal population shifts, then people will obviously vote for somebody else.
And that's what they did. And green energy went down in flames, pun intended. So maybe that is the canary in the coal mine for our election. Final thought, Governor Perry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that segment, it was spot on. I think this guy sees it very well, what's happening in Europe. They truly were the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. I think you're going to see a massive turnout for President Trump. People saw through that sham process and that prosecution that happened in New York. They're going to turn out. We're going to do a great job of getting early votes. We're going to, we're going to do hand-to-hand combat, so to speak, in the electoral process with the Democrats and turning our vote out. And I think the day after the election in November, there's going to be a lot of happy, common sense Americans.
Right. And then a lot of them are in Texas. You were ahead of your time. It's now the number one issue in Texas, now the number one issue in the country, and that's the border. Number two is immigration. Thanks so much, Governor. Always appreciate your dual expertise, energy, as well as running this state. Governor Perry, thank you. All right. When we come back, I'm going to take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Also, Tom Fitton will join us. He'll bring a new perspective on why Hunter Biden end up in court on gun charges. You're going to want to hear it. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back. It was always great to hear from Governor Perry. Guy knows so much. I'm sure that President Trump is going to tap him again for something. If I were him, I would want to enjoy my life and not go back to Washington. But he did a great job as Secretary of Energy, was a fantastic governor here. And I know he ran for president, and I also thought he did a good job on Dancing with the Stars. I don't know where that ends up on his resume, but I think it's important. So in about 10 minutes, we're going to get a perspective about what led to Hunter Biden's conviction on these gun charges, which were a layup. It's so obvious he was on crack when he checked a box that said he wasn't on drugs. It was so obvious he held that gun in haphazard fashion. It was so obvious when that gun was tossed into a dumpster, it was his responsibility. And then he lied about the whole thing. And I just go back to the bigger story, and that is the laptop. The laptop that they told us was not real, which we all knew was real, and now they use it as evidence against him. When you look at that laptop, how could you possibly say, I know the problem with Hunter Biden? It's the guns, the one gun he bought. Nothing else on there is illegal and irresponsible. Remember when Joe Biden said this? Cut 8.
First of all, my son's done nothing wrong. I trust him. I have faith in him. He did not do a single thing wrong, as everybody's investigated.
God love you, man.
You're a one-horse pony, which is the wrong way to say it. So they were just wondering what you thought about Hunter, the international business dealings, the crack addiction, the prostitutes, the love child that you don't acknowledge. Congressman James Comer has been pursuing the real story with the Biden family and whether Joe Biden was involved in his international business dealings. And by the way, where is all the money he made? Cut 15.
Justice has not been served. Justice will not be served until the Department of Justice takes into account all of the financial crimes that the entire Biden family committed. It wasn't just Hunter Biden. It was also Joe Biden and Jim Biden. The entire family benefited from the Biden influence peddling schemes. We had three people testify who were once partners with Hunter Biden in these schemes. They testified under oath that the Bidens were selling the Biden brand. They were selling access to Joe Biden. There was never a legitimate business.
That's what's been driving him crazy. He's been unable to get to thoroughly the bottom of it, but exposed a heck of a lot, James Comer. I am not sure if the Republicans can hold the House. I have not met anybody who says it's a given, nor anyone says it's out of play. But if they continue to pursue this, if he wins and they continue to pursue this, I'm sure it'll be unmasked. The one thing I wonder is, does he cut a deal? Does he cut a deal before the tax charges? Because if you unwind the tax charges to find out what exactly he earned and where the money came from, and you do a forensic accounting, it'll blow up everything. I'm sure even Trump haters and Biden supporters, and there's a handful, know that they were up to no good. And why Hunter Biden was leading it is still beyond me. When we come back, we talk to Tom Fitton, whose Judicial Watch unearthed so much of the information that we've gotten to digest over the last few weeks. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show in the beautiful studios, KLIF.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Politically, this is a big blow to Trump. And that's, I think, the if you're looking for just political fallout, he's trying so hard to create this weaponization. And this has been a Republican talking point for so long.
You have a president of the United States who is living embodiment of the rule of law, even with respect to his only living son.
Republicans have really struggled to make this line of attack stick because most people see this and feel sympathy.
Hunter Biden received a comforting hug from his dad, the president of the United States, on a day that provided very clear evidence that the justice system is not weaponized.
Really? Okay, nice music in the background. So that's the Democratic spin on what happened yesterday, convicting Hunter Biden on three counts on his weapons charge and falsifying documents as it relates to that gun. We caught the video. You see it on video, into the dumpster. You see the text messages. It was an open and shut case. There was no reason to have this trial. They had no plan. Abby Lowell, evidently this great attorney, I have no idea if it was even possible to mount a defense for this. And then a lot of people were saying, well, why are they charging him on a gun charge? Would they have charged anybody else? Trey Gowdy have said on that. I think it's important to forensically go back to from when they told us the laptop was fake Russian disinformation to now it's used against Hunter Biden in a case from the Justice Department. And the guy that could do that is Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton. Tom, welcome. Can you give our audience a perspective on how he ended up on trial for gun charges? How hard you had to work behind the scenes to expose this stuff?
Oh, we worked publicly. I mean, we had to sue both the Secret Service and the FBI to find out more details about their cover-up because, as you may recall, there were reports that they showed up at the gun store almost immediately, either the Secret Service or the FBI. We sued the Secret Service, and we got the document saying, well, maybe someone called in a favor because no one quite knew what was happening. And, of course, the FBI was involved. But it all highlighted and exposed to the public, in addition to those whistleblowers, that they were sitting on this case for 6 years. This is 2018 that happened.
And so he knew he was being charged. He was charged for 6 years, or they were investigating for 6 years?
No, they knew what he had done 6 years ago. So gotcha. They had all the elements of the charge or the crime 6 years ago, and they sat on it for 6 years. And they were dragged kicking and screaming into this prosecution. So the idea that this demonstrates the rule of law is really half-baked. The trial was run well. He was given a fair hearing, unlike Trump, and he was found guilty of real, actual crimes, unlike Trump. But the process to get there was terribly corrupted in the sense that it shouldn't have taken 6 years. And the idea that, you know, somehow he was treated differently, he was, in the sense that they waited 6 years. They had him, you know, they had evidence that he was misusing the gun. The gun was dumped. It's the sort of conduct that would have resulted in attention being paid by prosecutors. And they did try to handle it normally but corruptly by trying to bury the charge with these other tax charges last year and that plea deal was blown apart because the court just asked some simple questions and the whole corrupt mess fell in on itself.
So people say, well, you know, why the gun? You look at the laptop. The least offensive thing is the gun charge. It's so obvious he's guilty, obviously, and the jury said the same thing. But there's so many other things on there. For example, he's doing these international business dealings. He never registered as a foreign agent, but they let the statute of limitations evaporate on that. And that's only left the gun charge. And remember the sweetheart deal that he had that was exposed by a honorable judge.
This was the bare minimum in order to get the public and Congress and others off their back and potentially distract from those other issues that you're talking about. And so, you know, the way to think about this, in my view, this is a good step. It's a necessary step. It was right. But it's woefully insufficient given the other criminality that Joe and Hunter are involved in. And the tax charges that are coming up later this year are corrupted because, again, they sat on the charges. They constricted and constrained the investigation to protect Joe Biden. So, you know, Hunter went through this, but I suspect he's going to be pardoned in the end after the election. So he's not going to face any real consequence, I suspect. And if I'm in the new administration and I'm the new president, I'd be directing my Justice Department to take do an audit, A, of how the Justice Department handled this case. And an audit is my charitable way of saying criminally investigate. And then secondly, take a look at all of these Biden issues to make sure they're being seriously investigated. Finally.
Yeah, it would be interesting. So I want you to – Kayleigh McEnany has a theory, and she shared it with Jesse last night, Cut 18.
I would be stunned if Hunter Biden did not take a plea deal ahead of the tax charges.
Really?
That is where you start getting subpoena power. Yes, that is where you start getting subpoena power over all of these bank accounts that Comer is talking about. He subpoenaed them on the congressional level, but they start coming into a live court case. There is simply no way they allow that to go to trial when they know they've got, to your point, if you don't want to pardon Hunter, you've got a commutation in your back pocket. You're either going to be a lame duck president or a second term president, more likely the first. He's going to pardon his son. His son's going to take a plea deal.
What do you think?
I think that's a persuasive analysis. Trey Gowdy made the same point yesterday. He's going to plead guilty and just wait for Biden to pardon him after the election. And the politics of it won't be problematic for Biden. He'll get pinged, but many people won't give him too much guff because, after all, it's his son. And the media will protect him from being held accountable for this investigative process that protected Joe Biden in the end as he threw his son under the bus.
What about these 51 intel agents that signed off on this that we now know the FBI has confirmed that we all knew for certain, and you've been suing to prove it, that the laptop was real, it was his, was not even manipulated, let alone not be his. So what about that? I mean, what about the 51 people? I mean, should they be held accountable? They are not backing away from their from what they signed off on.
Well, they leveraged the public good they have, the public benefit they have, which is a security clearance, to mess with the election. And that security clearance and those security clearances, there should be a process and for removing them. And that's something the next honest administration should do. And according to Boss Bragg up in New York, what they did was a crime. You know, the new rule is, Brian, if you manage a story as a politician or help a politician manage a story, that's all reportable on FEC forms. And if you're not reporting them, you know, you're part of a conspiracy, and all of that subjects you to criminal investigation and prosecution. I say that sarcastically, but, you know, the point is, there's got to be some type of accountability. as they make up crimes against Trump, we have this real evidence of corruption and misconduct by public officials, or people have, as I say, the kind of the accoutrements of public being a public official, meaning a security clearance, and nothing's done.
Right.
Something has to be done. There's got to be a consequence. We won't be able, you know, we can talk about reforms and whatever. The best reform is a consequence and prosecutions for government misconduct and criminality.
Right. And now we're at this new thing called Lawfare, which we're seeing in New York. Do you have a sense of what July 11th will bring for the former president? That's his sentencing day. I know during his screening call with probation officers, he didn't admit guilt. They usually want you to admit guilt and talk about how reformed you are. Trump's not doing that. How does that play into what prosecution will ask for and what the judge will give?
I mean, I fear they're going to put him in jail. I don't know if they will or not, but I fear that. And I don't trust the ordinary course taking place, which is would be that he wouldn't necessarily get any jail time. If I were the president, I would be directing my lawyers to exercise every available legal option to end this hostage situation. Judge Merchan and that court process that is corrupted is holding our elections hostage. They're holding our election hostage, and they're abusing Trump and his civil rights. And federal courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, in my view, should intervene to shut it down.
You don't think his lawyers are doing enough? Tom, you don't think his lawyers are doing enough?
I don't know what they're doing. I'm just saying if I were in Trump's shoes, I wouldn't wait for Merchan to put me in jail before he did something about it.
Right, I just don't know what legal recourse you have.
So wired and rigged, you know. And to me, the damage is ongoing. You know, he's currently has a gag order against him. His freedom is somewhat restricted as it is, and everything he says can and will be used against him in a sentencing. I mean, our campaign, our presidential election, has been hijacked by Judge Merchan in an improper way, but for non-crimes. And, you know, all those issues they have on appeal, I would just bring it up to the Supreme Court and say this is all politicized and, you know, you let terrorists come in and get habeas corpus support. Can you give some of the benefit of the doubt to a former president and current candidate who's being abused for unprecedented, for unprecedented applications of the law here? My gosh.
It would be unbelievable.
About this. Yeah. I can't believe we're in this situation. And the federal courts have got to do their job.
And one guy who let everybody know he's a Democrat, who gave to Joe Biden's campaign, who ruled against the defense at every turn, will be in charge of the president's fate. By all accounts, not only is he winning close in the battleground states, he's put New Hampshire and Virginia in play, and maybe even New York. Tom Fitton, thanks so much. And how hard you work to expose all that stuff on the laptop, Judicial Watch. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for sharing the story.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
All right. You got it. Listen, when we come back, we got a few more minutes. Also more on Caitlin Clark and some of the fallout from her not being on the Olympic team, which, by the way, I have no problem with. People are just weighing in. I don't believe she's one of the top 12 players. That should be the story. Dave Portnoy does not agree with me. Maybe you don't. Will Cain doesn't agree with me either. Maybe you don't. Also, Paul Ryan sat down with Neil Cavuto, big critic of Trump, but you'll be surprised on where they both agree. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show on the road on KLIF in Dallas.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We are back. So I'm just going to, we got some things to go over. First off, when it comes to Caitlin Clark, everybody, I love the fact that attendance is up 400%. Ratings are up 400%+. People are talking about it. They keep fouling her, the outstanding Iowa point guard. And they feel as though, even though she's had an uneven start, pretty strong for a rookie, but not the best player in the league, they think she should have been one of the 12 to play in the Olympic team. And who cares, because we're so much better. We're not going to pay the price because Caitlin Clark might not be ready. I think about the 12th player that actually is better than her that would have been on there, maybe fit better. Do you need a guard? Do you need Do you need a forward? Do you need a center? Whatever it is, Brittany Griner will be on the team. She's been a legend for a long time. I don't have a problem with it. A lot of people do. Jen Rosati, the standout point guard from UConn, was there when basketball emerged on the women's side, when they used to get sellouts with Rebecca Lobo and Carol Walters. And, of course, Gina Auriemma is still there today. And she talked about that. She's USA Women's Basketball chairperson. Here's what she said about the decision, Cup 43.
Obviously, we know the success that Caitlin had in college, and she's had a tremendous start to the WNBA season so far. You know, essentially, it was the committee's job to pick the 12 that, you know, based on our selection criteria. And, you know, they're as much as you want to maybe make conversation around how we should have considered TV viewership or jersey sales or popularity, that wasn't the purview of the committee to have those discussions. The selection criteria were very clear, was made very clear to us. And so eventually, you know, we had to block out some of that outside noise. And it wasn't, it was a hard decision for a lot of players that didn't make the team.
Yeah, I mean, just to pick 12 players, just think about how many great women's players. And they're going to have they'll have one or two tough games, but they should win the gold. We'll see. Jen Rosati, oh, by the way, was a fantastic player. Number two, I think she's right. I don't think ratings should matter. I really don't. And who's the best team in boxing? You would never say, well, the third place guy's got a lot of charisma and a great smile. No, they lost. So the other thing is in entertainment, we know about the whole cancel culture. Kevin Spacey is one of the people that was one of the most respected actors on Broadway and in film. And then he found out to be somebody who looked very much the aggressor when it came to same-sex harassment. So he was talking to Piers Morgan yesterday. And by the way, the lawsuits keep coming, even though he beats most of them. Here's what he said, Cut 42.
What's your idea of bad behavior when you look back at what you were doing?
Pushing the boundaries.
In what way? I mean,
being too handsy, you know, touching someone sexually,
groping people
in a way that I didn't know at the time they didn't want.
Evidently, got really upset during it. Talked about being broke and having looking to get involved in another project. Evidently, he's not the best to work with. Alienated a lot of people along the way. Maybe he's getting what he deserves. The other thing to keep in mind, Andrew Cuomo's back in the news. He's going to be, believe me, if Mayor Adams can't run, he's going to run again. And to do it, he wants to clean up his act when it comes to what happened in the nursing homes. I don't think it's possible. Finally, the House called him in to explain himself behind closed doors. Here's what he said and how it went. Cut 39.
That directive followed the CMS and CDC federal guidance. That's been proven by two investigations. If I knew then what I know now, I would have told my Department of Health, don't listen to the federal government. They don't know what they're talking about.
So he's blaming the federal government for sticking seniors back in nursing homes where they got infected and died. He went on, Cut 40.
You know, 4 years ago, the Republican administration accused New York and other Democratic states of mismanaging the COVID situation, specifically mismanaging it in nursing homes. And they called for a Department of Justice investigation against just four Democratic states. It's ironic today that you hear complaints about the weaponization of the justice system when they nuclearized the justice system against Democratic states.
You know why? It's because you people locked everything down and refused to open it up. You people shut down schools and refused to open it up. Led by Anthony Fauci, we find out the folly of his opinions and his mandates, how little it helped, how you kowtowed to the teachers' unions, how you battled with your own mayor. And if there were Republicans that were shut down Republicans, they would have been attacked by the Justice Department under Bill Barr. No doubt about it. He was trying to get people to get back in action. It was 2 or 3 weeks to shut down the spread. When it stopped spreading, you refused to open it up and wanted money to pay people not to work. That's the reason. And that was on display the week before with Anthony Fauci. For all of New York, please remember what an arrogant buffoon Andrew Cuomo is, and do not get nostalgic for his arrogance. Do not put him back in office, no matter what you think of Eric Adams. Quick note, Jerry West has passed away, one of the greatest players ever. He is the emblem and the shadow of the NBA. He was not treated well by that series. It was just on HBO, but he was a great person, a fantastic GM who rebuilt the Lakers, did a good job in Memphis. Also, Tony Lobianco has passed away, too. He's a very heralded actor. Actor, director, writer, producer, Academy Award winning, known for The French Connection, Tony nominated, Best Actor winner of the Outer Critics Award. He has passed away, and he will be missed. Tony Lobianco is dead. Thanks for listening.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from the beautiful studios, KLIF, right here in Dallas, Dallas-Fort Worth. It's a fantastic day we had at QB's, and it was great to see everybody in person on Fox and Friends for 3 hours. Now we're back doing 3 hours here, back in the plane, be back in New York tomorrow. This hour, we're going to be joined by former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, as well as Professor Wilfred Riley. He's got a great book out, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, Debunking the False Narratives, Defining America's School Curricula. So he's going to be with us shortly. So before we get to the speaker, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
It should come as a shock to no one that Mr. Sinwar cares nothing at all about the lives of innocent Palestinians that have been caught up in this war, a war he started.
Right, Admiral. So why should we care? He loves it. Sinwar, the Hamas mastermind, admits what we all knew. He wants Palestinians to die. He reportedly said that as Palestinians' deaths are a necessary sacrifice as Israel rejects Hamas counter demands and the world turns on the good guys.
Number two.
Politically, this is a big blow to Trump. He's trying so hard to create this weaponization.
Most people see this and feel sympathy.
A day that provided very clear evidence that the justice system is not weaponized.
Hunter convicted. Jurors speak. Trump haters call it all even on the justice front. Not me.
Number one.
We've seen the threat from foreign terrorists rise to a whole nother level. This is by no means a time to let up or dial back.
Terrorists among us. The border breaches have the FBI hunting down 8 would-be terrorists in 3 major cities. Yes, illegals continue to pour in. The executive order is a joke. The bright spot, Texas, because they took things into their own hands. And it's cost them a lot. How about $11 billion for Operation Lone Star? Think about the billions New York has spent putting up anywhere between 60 and 85,000 illegals, free room and board, and the damaging crime they bring with them. Speaker McCarthy, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. I'm sitting in your chair in the New York studio.
Do you feel powerful?
I feel powerful, but, you know, you need to be nervous. I don't have a job, so.
Well, I'm pretty sure you can make a few speeches and they can pay your bills. And I think Donald Trump will hire you if he can win.
There we go. He's going to win. You know, I was with him this Monday down in Palm Beach, and he is more disciplined than I've ever seen him. We were looking through the amount of money he's raised just in this short amount of time, and he just did a very successful swing through California, Silicon Valley, L.A., and Newport. And I will tell you, I'm finding people who have not been with him before not only are with him now, but are openly with him because they're so frustrated with what has gone on.
Well, you mean the terrible performance of this administration, or do you think that Trump has changed a little?
You know what? I believe in the 10,000 hours. You always improve if you want to. And I will tell you, his team, Susie and all of them, have done a tremendous job because think about what's been coming at them this entire time, right? The weaponization, putting them before court, holding them up in there. And he, every time he had to go to court, he would go out and he would talk about the issues where the president never did anything. And the country, because it's such a close time period, these 4 years, they know what they had, what type of policies, what type of America, what type of world we had under Trump, and what do we have under Biden. So it's not a hard decision. I think that's why you see the big shift.
A couple of things. I saw the Politico story of Donald Trump. He's going to be addressing 200 business leaders today on Thursday.
That's big. Business roundtable.
Yeah, the business roundtable. Biden was invited, but he's got to go to the G7. That's not his fault. But going back and forth, I found interesting. But what it seems to have done is he's won over a lot of the business leaders who have come out flat out against him, especially after January 6th. And they all put their name down there. And they said, you know, we're going to be supporting him because the not only is the economy challenging, but the regulation and the condemnation is something they never got from Trump. So money could be pouring in. Ken Ackman is one that did the same thing.
You know, the other thing, too, is they're also finding out when you talk to some of them that they were sold a bill of goods, meaning they said this Russia collusion, all this stuff they found out is not true. And he's finding that in a lot of parts of the country, President Trump is, that people have now come to the understanding when they have all the information, what did you do to this poor guy? And when you see this administration going in DEI, ESG and all that, business wants to go back to what they're supposed to do, run an effective business, employ more people, make a great environment for them to work and make them foster and do better instead of government dictating.
You have great connections with Wall Street. Eric Levine, a longtime GOP fundraiser, former Treasury official, now open to Trump. Sean McGuire, a partner at Sequoia Capital, former Hillary Clinton supporter, pledged $300,000 to a pro-Trump super PAC. John Katsimatidis, famous for being one of the most fair guys, and a multi-billionaire, as you know, diverse, everything from owning WABC to owning the best
grocery stores
and refineries around. He's supporting Trump. And then I'm looking at other guys that have been critics. CEO of Blackstone, Steve Schwarzman, once labeled the U.S. Capitol insurrection, something they can never get a front and all these things. He looks like he's coming aboard. Bill Ackman, the same thing, was with DeSantis. Citadel's Ken Griffin, too. So this is significant. So the money probably will not be an issue as much as Joe Biden has raised. My worry is this, Mr. Speaker. Are they building out the battleground infrastructure? Because I'm seeing stories that the Wisconsin infrastructure is not there. The Pennsylvania infrastructure is not there, even though the polls are strong. Have you heard the same thing?
Well, I see things on the ground, too. And remember, when we won in 2016, it was Hillary who didn't build out. I've watched this Trump campaign team be more professional than I've ever seen. They've worked through some very tough times, and they're great. So the thing you got to look at, think about Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So if you look at the polling and you take it from 4 years ago to today, it's an 8% movement to Trump. If you look at President Biden's approval rating, it's down to the lowest of any president has at this time going forward. So let's say Arizona, he's ahead. Trump wins Arizona. Let's say Georgia, he's been ahead of Georgia the whole time. He wins because he only lost Arizona by 10,000. He only lost Georgia by 12,000. Let's put those away, say they got it. We then go to Nevada, which President Trump lost by 33,000. The numbers look good. The crowd looks good. Say he wins, although, but you also have to remember Maine and Nebraska do electoral college by congressional district. Last time, Trump won one of the congressional districts. They only have two. But whoever wins the overall vote wins the other two electoral votes for the Senate. So he picks those up. If he wins all that, he's still not at 270. So it's really going to come down to Michigan, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin. He needs to pick up one of those. Wisconsin, he was only down 20,000 votes last time. So really going into the ground game, we're putting our convention there. That could be the whole race. But remember, Trump is expanding the playing field. We're looking at Virginia now. We're looking at Minnesota. When you expand the playing field, you're on offense, and that's harder for the Democrats. So the ground game, we got to make sure it's right. We got to make sure these votes. The one thing I think the president does very smart is don't wait till election day to vote. You got to vote early.
So one person that you have no love lost for is Congresswoman Nancy Mace. Mm-hmm. She was primaried. She prevailed. This is what she said. Cut 38.
We've got a very slim majority right now in the House. I'm working really hard. I have the most expensive Republican primary in South Carolina history a week from tomorrow on June 11th. I've got guys like Kevin McCarthy spending millions, to the tune of $6 million right now. And as soon as I get through this election, I'm going to be focused on swing districts, swing states, carrying the message of how do we win over independent voters? How do we win back women?
Are you disappointed she didn't lose?
Look, the voters are able to do what they say. The thing you learn is the Trump endorsement is very strong. My only fear is that we could come back and have a special election here. You see what came out just in the last couple of days about the allegation that she took taxpayers' money to refund something that she wasn't paying for, but they'll have to go through that. Look, I think the real race is a week from now, Bob Good against Navy SEAL John McGuire. This is a place that I've really engaged in the race. President Trump has well. I think when you look at Bob Good and what he has not brought home for the district, that's the real race everybody's looking at.
So would you, Bob Good is somebody that's been a thorn in the side even of the Freedom Caucus?
Yeah, he's the head of the Freedom Caucus, and he's been endorsing in a lot of these primaries and losing. He and Matt Gaetz, they've lost, I think, every primary they pretty much endorsed in and trying to challenge these incumbents. But John McGuire is a state senator, a Navy SEAL, an extraordinary background. He's into this race, and President Trump has recently endorsed him as well, John McGuire. And on Tuesday, we'll have this election, and I think this will be a much stronger place. The party will be coming back together. Look, I've spent my time building this majority and want to make sure I keep it. I know in the House we're a little behind on money. I've been raising it in there for their super PAC. I just went through California raising it because, remember, I was able to gain 5 seats in California, 5 in New York. These are big ways. If we win the majority, we got to make sure those members have the resources they need.
Jamal Bowman looks like he's about to get crushed in a Democratic primary. Does that make that seat harder to get?
That seat's a Democrat seat, very hard to win otherwise. But what is very strong is Bowman loses that socialist Hamas wing of the Democratic Party will be sent a real clear message.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. He pulls firearms. He comes out against Israel.
This guy was a principal in schools and pulls a fire alarm. I mean, my gosh.
Mr. Speaker, stay right there because very few people know more about international relations than you. I want to get you to weigh in on Israel and the chaos that's happening in the city you're in right now, New York City. Also, find out where you think the peace agreement is between those two. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Speaker Kevin McCarthy was so glad you're here.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm not in a position to confirm the specific reporting in the Wall Street Journal about Sinwar, but I will say this. It should come as a shock to no one that Mr. Sinwar cares nothing at all about the lives of innocent Palestinians that have been caught up in this war, a war he started.
That is Admiral Kirby talking about the quotes from Sinwar, who says he loves the Palestinian casualties, and the longer he can hold out without a peace deal, the more the world turns on Israel. Knowing this, we all figured that, but knowing this, why do we still play into his hands and continue to turn on our ally? Speaker Kevin McCarthy joins us now. He's actually in studio in New York. I'm over in Dallas. So first off, Mr. Speaker, your reaction to Sinwar's quotes.
Well, it's something we've always known. This is a terrorist organization, does not care about human life, is willing to sacrifice it to make falsities going forward. You've watched, they're still holding hostages. They're still holding American hostages. And for our president to ever put doubt into whether we will stand behind Israel has been a weakness. And you want to think for one moment, you always want to stop back, take a step back and look, why are we where we currently are? When President Biden came into office, you had a change in the Middle East. You had the Abraham Accords taking hold. But because they came under President Trump, he did not push them. And then he changed the policy with America on what we did with when it came to Iran. Iran at the time was only producing 400,000 barrels a day. Today they're producing 3 million. What does that mean when the price of oil is about $80? They're getting billions of dollars. And when Iran has extra money, what they do is fund terrorist organizations like Hamas. This is why we're in the situation we are today. And then you watched what he did in Afghanistan. It then pushed our allies to move towards China. You watched what he did to Saudi Arabia. You then brought China into the Middle East where they have not been to brokering some type of agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. This is a place that America stands strong. And so it's just our weakness. Five embassies have been evacuated. You've got now a world that looks like the 1930s with this axis of evil where Iran, Russia, North Korea, and China are all bound together. This was not the world it looked like 4 years ago. And so this is why foreign policy matters. And it's what's been said about Biden when he was a vice president, when he was senator. Every foreign policy decision he has made has been wrong.
But let's look at this specifics when it comes to Hamas. They want a ceasefire. It looks like we want a ceasefire, but they want a permanent ceasefire. They also want Israel or us to pay for the total rebuilding of Gaza. I'm telling you right now, nobody I know would sign off on rebuilding Gaza. You got to be kidding me. And you can't end this war with him still alive. He's got to be killed or captured. Why do we have short-term memory loss when it comes to how to deal with terrorists?
Think about what the world looked like when Reagan came in and what the world looked like when Reagan left. And one of those principles was you do not negotiate with terrorists, right? They are holding hostages. You want to make sure they never take an American hostage again. So you do not negotiate with them. Why would you pay to build it back when they take the money of what was provided before to build tunnels, to take people underneath hospitals and schools so the innocent people are threatened, and you watch what he's done, just sacrificing them at the same time. You've got to negotiate from strength.
How much leverage do we have over Israel? At what point can they just say we're doing our own thing?
Look, Israel is always their own country. It's what I've admired about their leadership and others, but they respect America greatly. And remember, they are sitting in the Middle East as a democracy surrounded by people who want to destroy them.
But how much leverage do they have?
America has a great deal of leverage because of our friendship. Yes.
But we arm them. So they can't they wanted to get their own industrial base, and Barack Obama told them not to, right?
Yeah. And Israel is very advanced, but they make the most out of the smallest thing. They have desalination plants. Their technology is amazing because they do it on their own. But we have, when you look at what we've been able to develop together from technology and others and defense system and others, it's a benefit for both of us. But it's also a shared love for one another. And when you question that, it sends the wrong signals around the world that puts greater pressure on Israel.
Just tell you about what a backwards world we have. We have protesters chanting for Hamas in New York City and Washington, D.C., and they have a daring hostage rescue, and they condemn the Israelis for killing Palestinians on the way in and out. Here's Dan Abrams, of all people, who said this about how twisted this all is. Cut 29.
Now, on its surface, the successful rescue of four Israeli civilians would seem like cause to celebrate it, right? At least for anyone who believes that terrorists kidnapping civilians from a concert, dragging them into enemy territory, and holding them prisoner for 8 months is actually a really bad thing. But this unbelievable movie-like rescue that successfully extracted four civilians from Gaza, got them safely back to Israel, succeeded on a sort of different level than just the mission. It has successfully exposed the hypocrisy and lies from Hamas supporters around the world.
And the media is making Israel seem like the bad guys.
How are they? That young woman captured from a concert.
I know.
We all saw her face on that motorcycle with these men around her. Who knows what has happened to this poor woman for 8 months, her family there. But what about all the others that are still there? They took infant children. They took grandparents.
It doesn't seem to matter to the rest of the world. Speaker McCarthy, always fantastic to talk to you. My audience loves it. Professor Wilford Riley is next. Thanks so much for listening, and see you soon, Kevin.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. One of the great things about having a radio show is being able to talk to people long form, not 4 or 5 minutes, nothing against TV. But we got these things called commercials that cut us off. We got to get right to it. Professor Wilford Riley is kind enough to be on TV and radio with us and endorse a couple of my books. He joins us now, an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University, author of the brand new book called Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, Debunking the False Narratives Defining American School Curricula. Professor, welcome back.
Good to be back. Good to be on the show.
Why do you think now's the right time to write this book?
I think now we might be at kind of a strike point when it comes to what's called wokeness, where we're really ready to talk about some of the things we've been saying about American society, especially on the left, for a long time, and discuss whether or not they're actually true.
And now you deal with this on a regular basis in your classroom?
Well, in my classroom, so I teach at Kentucky State U, which is one of the many great state universities in the country. It's also a historically black college. And we're actually not as woke as you might expect. I mean, typical state U in the South, I mean, you have a lot of people that want to be cops, lawyers, nurses. So I think when you see people with purple hair rioting on television, you're usually talking about one of like 20 bespoke colleges that almost no one goes to, you know, Oberlin, Bowdoin, something like that. We have student protests and so on here occasionally, but we get a pretty broad range of thought in the classroom. The thing that I do notice about it, though, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that a lot even of our kids have only ever heard like one side of the argument. So everyone's familiar with Martin Luther King or W.E.B. Du Bois, but not really with Thomas Sowell. Everyone's read Karl Marx usually 6 or 7 times. But no one's read Milton Friedman or Hayek. So part of your goal as a teacher, if you're on the center or the right, is to fill in that giant gap, you know, in a sector that right now, and this isn't inherently bad, but it's about 80% female, leans about 93% to the left. There's a lot of work to be done in terms of balancing kids out.
Right. So you grew up, what is your background? You're black.
True.
So what were you told? What kind of schools did you go to? When did you realize, were you going to school that was more open to America not being a terrible place?
Well, I think that's actually a really good question because so my book, as you mentioned, my book is called Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. And it's a response to this whole like shelf of books that have come out for really the past 50 years. Right. I mean, so Lies My Teacher Told Me is one of the best selling ed books of all time. You know, then you've got Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, A Native History of the United States. You've got 1619. I think that's subtitled A Black History of the United States. You've got that old Tommy Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, The Lies They're Telling You. I mean, so this is a whole thing that's been nearly dominant for some time. And that's one of two points I make in the book. Like, when you send your kid to a public school, a government school, and often, honestly, if you live in a nice neighborhood, you're going to do that, there are two things they're going to hear. One is that the United States, the Western world, the white man, this is the most evil society in history. You know, we killed the Indians, had slaves, dropped big bombs on our enemies, this kind of thing. But also, too, you're going to hear this idea that there's something arcane and forbidden about this knowledge that you're now hearing. Your parents didn't necessarily hear it. They might not be ready for it. You are getting woke to some extent. You're being awakened to reality. And what I say in the book, first of all, the Western world is not the worst society of all time. We're probably the best. Things like abuse and war, all humans for all time have committed. If anything, the modern Western world ended those things first. But secondarily, like this kind of rebel, radical position, it's not new. It's not original. It's been the mainstream, boring, kind of failing commie position for most of my adult life and kind of the American middle class. In terms of my schools, to respond to your question, one of them was a Catholic school in Chicago, and it taught a classical curriculum, and it was actually really useful. But in the mainstream sort of public schools, yeah, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, we were learning pretty much the same thing we're learning now. Native Americans were peaceful people dancing with wolves and all that.
Yep, I hear you. So that's what I was taught, too, that while we never ducked slavery talk, and they talked about how evil it was, and we remember Roots was that – was the series, TV series that I saw in grade school that was the number one series, I think, ever. It did not color early America in glory. It was the brutality of slavery. And Alex Haley, I think, had the number one best-selling book for a long time, even before that. But I don't understand. You could love your country and know it's not perfect, correct?
Yes, of course you can love your country and know it's not perfect. And I want to get back to that point you just made there, because, like, very often, like, you know, I'll banter back and forth with students. I'm still just now 40. I think I'm a likable guy. But students will say things like, well, back when you were a kid, you know, how was slavery? Like, you know, you'll trade jokes and all this. And it's a funny line, but it's important to realize that when I was a kid, you're talking about the 1990s in Chicago. Society, I mean, the North integrated in the 1920s. So when you're talking about, like, this sort of left-wing curriculum, whites and blacks getting along pretty well, the teachers were mostly liberal, democratic women. I mean, this has been going on for everybody's entire life. So that again, is this point. This is not some radical new thing that we had to give a chance after decades of oppression. This is – we all grew up with this as kids. Yeah, like Roots is still the number one most watched TV miniseries of all time. I think Roots was 1978.
Yeah. I mean, it was right. By the way, yeah, right after we're celebrating the bicentennial. So,
Yeah, 1976 in the North was the bicentennial. It was O.J. Simpson and Walter Payton. I mean, it's not that there was no racism. It's that this is an era where most of us, black, white, whatever, just sort of existed and were moving forward. But one of the trends that was happening in society that a lot of people weren't aware of is that the activist political left was becoming really, really entrenched in certain sectors. Now, they don't run society. We're not a communist country. But, you know, higher education, secondary education, the media, and that produced a lot of the things that we're seeing today. Like, you're not – when you think about the most bizarre little things, like, hey, it looks like 60% of the people in television advertising are in unrealistically pretty interracial couples, just random details of society, that is correct. And there are people that are putting that image forward. And it's sometimes worth asking why.
And it's worth asking, and you put that out there in this book. Why are people attacking all these institutions? You write a couple of things. Slavery was one of the truths that people think is slavery was virtually unique to America and the West. That is, was on every continent in the world for generations, right?
Yeah, I mean, so slavery was just the level of human development after killing and eating your defeated enemies. I mean, one of the points that I make in this book is that contemporary Western morality, and I think it's gotten a little too weak in recent years as kind of muscular Christianity has faded away, but I mostly think it's a good thing. But contemporary Western empathy-based morality, that's only like 200 years old. And prior to that, it didn't exist anywhere on Earth. So, I mean, when you look around, like Brown versus Board, the case that finally desegregated the last holdout region in the USA, the Deep South, was 1954. But we're not just talking about the USA here in terms of racial and regional conflict. Like the Geneva Conventions, which banned torture and sexual abuse and so on of prisoners of war, and obviously there are players like Hamas that still ignore those, that's 1949. I mean, the end of the actual right of conquest, where you could just ride over someone's border on your war horse and take their land, that was 1946. So before that period, the rule everywhere in the world was that if you fought what was called honest war, there was a challenge back and forth, there were atrocities back and forth, and you won, you then owned the country that had previously belonged to someone else. I mean, you could kill the officers of the defeated army. Other people would frequently become slaves or serfs. I mean, I'm not approving of this, but saying this was unique to the United States of America is an extraordinarily kind of time-limited, nuanced view. So, yeah, I mean, I make that point in the book, and I go into that in some detail.
Professor Wilford Riley, my guest, my liberal teacher told me, lies my liberal teacher told me, debunking the false narratives, defining America's school curricula. So, Professor, the other thing I'd like to add to that, we're the only country that I know of that conquers a country and rebuilds it and leaves. We did the same thing with Germany, rebuilds it and left. Did it with Japan, rebuilt it and left. We're now allies. Do people not take pride in that? Do they not understand that? We're the ones who left. Guess who stayed? The Soviets. They stayed everywhere, and they dominated, and they basically made those countries answer to them for an extra 60 years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little less merciful and empathic than the American standard. I mean, it's like the old military joke. You know, if we're going to keep fighting these Arab countries, I don't know why the price of gas is going up. You know, I'm not as I mean, definitely we have been we have been as merciful as required and more in most of our recent wars. So, but in terms of, so you're saying that America is not being criticized from the right for that. We're being criticized from the left for that. That's an interesting point. I think that a lot of the reflexive criticisms of the USA and the West come from a deep place of kind of ignorance and not knowing, honestly. I don't think that most of the people that are launching these broadsides at the USA for fighting at all are aware of the sweep of historical conquest. But yeah, if you're familiar with history at all or with what other countries, China, Mongolia, Germany, the USSR have done, then yeah, the USA during our tenure as the Rome of the moment has been remarkably kind. And there are a bunch of stories. Conquering and rebuilding Japan and Germany, not just the rebuilding, but breaking the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese and saving the world, that should give every American a great deal of pride. And in the book, I try to tell some of those stories, like one of them, the dueling Irish and Chinese railroad gangs that built the first two transcontinental railroads across the USA against the Indian warriors. In a positive kind of inspiring light, and contrast those with a lot of the negative, very civil rights focused stories we're hearing today. So it is kind of my point that we should focus on the great things we've done.
Absolutely. So how about this statement? You take on a lot of them. The founders counted slaves as 3/5 of a person, and the only victims of lynchings were black.
Yeah, well, the Three-Fifths Compromise was the anti-slavery position. I mean, I expect that to be one of the more controversial chapters, but that's something that's always kind of just annoyed me. That's why I put it in there. The most positive thing for a pro-black abolitionist would have been for black people to count as nothing at all. What the Southern slave masters wanted to do was count black people as full citizens while not letting us vote. So the idea that, you know, that this hateful country counted blacks as 3/5 of a man, that they counted slaves as 3/5 of a man because the number of citizens in your territory or in your state determined how many congressmen you got. So you wanted them to count for as little as possible if you were anti-slavery. So that's just a technical legal point. That was the strongly anti-slavery position. Not everyone who was lynched was black. That's one of those things that people have almost forgotten. And we see this often where history has been redefined. We should think a lot about civil rights. We should think a lot about Vietnam, so on down the line. But we shouldn't let those things eclipse the rest of history. Like what I just mentioned, the railroad building, the Wright brothers, the first telegraph, the Pony Express. So lynching or posse justice, it was often racist. But it's also just how you enforce the law before you had police. So, I mean, historically, there were about 3,000 black people lynched. There were about 1,500 whites lynched. And there were also, I'd say, about 1,000 Hispanics and Natives lynched.
Yeah, we're not pro-lynching. We're just trying to spread out.
Brian and I are both opposed lynching. It's good we have cops now.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad we're on the record. So it's important, too. And when it comes down to it, it seems to me that these politicians make things worse by thinking that to get the black vote, you have to go out and say everything that society has assumingly done wrong to them and pander. And I was sitting on the set with Charlamagne the God from The Breakfast Club. And when I played some of that Morehouse University graduation commencement, he thought it was ridiculous. He goes, absolutely. He goes, we don't want to hear that. Why don't you get inspirational? Why are you going out and making excuses for what obstacles that may be in their way?
Yeah, I mean, the Morehouse graduation speech from Biden was, I agree with Charlamagne. I like Charlamagne the God. I actually have Black Privilege, his book. Morehouse is a top probably 150 university in the country. I mean, there's a stereotype Morehouse man, which is sort of a black Ivy League guy. Now, Biden himself mentioned, he's exaggerating a little bit, but I have 10 or 12 of you guys in the White House. So there's a complete dichotomy between saying, okay, here I am at a college that's good enough to have the president speak. Maybe a little bit of affirmative action involved there, but not much. You know, I'm going to hire some of you guys at the next intern cycle on the one hand. And on the other hand, none of you have a chance in this life. You're just like George Floyd. It's got to be one or the other. And the reality is everybody knows it's number one, and that's why the president's there talking. So the question I and a lot of other black business types would ask is why the pretense of number two? That's not a compliment to us. That's not a compliment to anyone. And it's an insult to America.
Got it. Professor, it's a fascinating book. Congratulations on getting it out. It is called Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, Debunking the False Narratives, Defining America's School Curriculum. Professor Wilfred Riley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Just finishing up here on KLIF. Thanks so much for everyone who came out to the restaurant today, Kluge's. It was great. And it was great to see everybody in person here in Dallas. And Will Kane to come out and help me out, too. Also at Daryl Johnston. Don't forget to watch the UFL this weekend, Sunday at 5 o'clock Eastern time on Fox. They got a great matchup between San Antonio and Birmingham. Birmingham lost one time in 2 years. The one game was to San Antonio. So UFL, it's got coverage by ESPN and Fox. It's going to work. Also, a quick announcement on June 29th. It's coming up in Indianapolis, Indiana. Tickets remain, not many, for History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. There's also meet and greet opportunities. I get a chance before the show to talk to you, answer anything that was going on in the news, as well as what's going on in history. As you know, I read 7 history books and have a chance to go back in history. It kind of chronicles our past as we come up on year 250. And then we'll be in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, July 27th. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com. We have not heard much from Paul Ryan, but he sat down with Neil Cavuto yesterday, and he actually took Trump's side. Cut 34.
There's a lot of Trump cases. This one here in New York, I think, was a bogus case. Alvin Bragg ran for office saying, I'm going to get Trump. Then he got it. He twisted a misdemeanor into a felony and got 34 felony convictions of it. If his name was Donald Cavuto, I bet these charges would not have been brought against him.
Probably would have been more charges.
Yeah, right. No, but I think the other cases are serious for Trump. I think the federal cases are much more serious and much more legitimate cases. I think this was a totally bogus case. So, yeah, I think unequal justice was applied in that particular Trump case.
Yeah, and we saw that. That's the former Speaker of the House. Still not a Trump fan. Many other people are. Hey, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. You can order any of my books, too. I can sign them and send them. Father's Day just days away.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.